Westside Church in Bend, Oregon. This is Behind the Message. In this podcast, we take you behind what we teach here at Westside. I'm Ben Fleming.
I'm Evan Earwicker, and we have Steve Mickle back with us.
Hello.
Hi, Steve.
So good to be back.
You are, I would say, our favorite former lead pastor of Westside Church.
Me too. Wow. I am my favorite former lead pastor of Westside.
No offense, Ken, if you're listening.
Yeah, I know exactly. Poor Pastor Ken.
First time we've been here during the week since you left.
You guys, I walked onto the campus, and I realized I hadn't been back on a Monday, a Tuesday, Wednesday. I mean, only on Sundays. And I was like, this is weird. I should have, I mean, it's been like over 12 months. I should have said hi to you guys.
It's all right.
It is. It's a weird thing, I think, in that you leave your position here, but then you become kind of over the church. So, and you're part of the church. So you're still very connected, but in such a different role now.
Yeah.
Is that weird?
It's very strange. Because I mean, I look at Westside so differently than I do the rest of the churches that I actually oversee. I mean, I know I'm like on paper in charge of all the churches, including Westside, but it doesn't, I just don't feel that way about Westside. You know, you guys are like full on in charge and you don't need me to hang over your shoulder. You guys doing everything all right?
There will be a time. It'll come.
I suppose a different personality type, if you were more, you know, domineering or controlling it would probably be hard to have you around for us.
I would imagine.
That's not the case. We've had you back. How many times you preached? Like
so
five
many.
Times,
yeah, so many times. And I actually, I'm not staying away on purpose. I mean, like, I do like you guys.
And you have a job. I do.
And I live in Redmond now, so I'm a little ways away geographically, but
Has the job grown a little bit too? So we've been using the number like 240 churches. You referenced a different number on Sunday. I can't remember what it was.
285 now.
Yeah.
285. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And so it's great. When we have about over 1,200 licensed pastors within that, all those churches, chaplains as well, that are not connected to a local church per se. And so, yeah, it's great.
We saw you at the district conference, of course. For those not familiar, we're part of a denomination. You oversee all the Northwest District from Alaska to
North Dakota.
The Dakotas, right?
Yeah.
And so proud of you leading in that context. We're way up in the rafters, just attending and watching you lead in this role. Yeah. I know it comes with some challenges. You're not doing a lot of... you're doing a lot of things that are unpleasant, right? Because you're going to churches to solve problems or deal with things.
For sure.
By definition. But in those moments, you can just see like your calling and your gifting lining up with your leadership in a really cool way.
Yeah. I feel like I needed that conference to actually remember why I said yes to this, you know, because for the first year, I had one conference, but somebody, the former supervisor, planned it. So it really wasn't my conference that I put on. That was my, you know, with my touch on it. And so this one was the first one to do that. And like you said, there are a lot of issues that I have to deal with in this job, legal issues, ethical issues. You know, I often say pastors are people too. and so they're just as broken as any of us. And so, but to come to that conference where it's about inspiration. It was really a great, great moment. Yeah.
Does it feel like pastoring still? You've always struck me as just so pastoral. And I think we put that title on a lot of people, but really we're talking about CEOs and we're talking about managers and we're talking about, you know, big personalities and stuff like that, which can fit into a pastor, I believe. But, you know, is this job still filling that thing in you that I know that is still pastoral?
Yeah, you know, it cannot be pastoral if you want it to be, because it's so positionally based, it's so organizational. Like, you know, I am in charge of churches, like, and so but if you look at it more like what Paul talks about as being a bishop, as an elder, then you've got something there. And so I've kind of changed the way I look at it as like, I'm a bishop, I'm a pastor to pastors. And coming into that space, pastors need pastors. They, I mean, very few pastors have someone that they can go to, that they can talk to, that they can get counsel from. And so, yeah. So anyway, that's been a great, like a blessing. And it's the reason why I felt like Jesus asked me to do it was to serve pastors, because we had a good thing going here. So why would I leave this with you guys? It's because of that, like that feeling of calling that God asked me to.
What do you miss the most about being here?
Yeah, it's this. It's being, like when I came back on today, just walking through the building, it's the interactions in the hallway with staff who are friends. You know, we were coworkers, but there was, and you know, I wasn't, you know, we made a joke. I wasn't here all that often, just because I would study from home or whatnot. And, but I was here 2 or 3 days a week, and that was life-giving. And now my team on the district staff are all distributed around the district. So I have one associate supervisor, like an assistant pastor who lives in Montana, another one that's up in Seattle. And so it's we're all just not together. And I miss that. I miss that being together with a team, doing life together. So I do miss that.
You prayed over the church. We invited you back on the 70th anniversary.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago. That
really
was awesome.
Yeah, it was really so fun. And I think for all of us, just reflecting on all that we've been a part of, deeply moving, I think. But for sure, when you stood up and prayed over the church, I could tell that there was, you know, a deeply moving thing that was happening. What were you feeling in that moment?
I mean, it was like you realize you're part of something, maybe bigger than you thought you were part of. I don't know. Like there was a sense of, like I'm in the flow of what Jesus did in a community and is continuing to do in a community, and so it felt, yeah. And you guys honored Suzanne and me, my wife and I, and we felt like we were valued and are a valued part of this community, and so that, yeah, it was astonishingly emotional for me, like to come back and feel the weight of that in a good way, you know, like this, like we got to be a part of this. And also, this community has walked with Suzanne and me through our darkest day of losing Chase, our son. And there's just something that happens when you go through dark seasons. Ben, you talked about in a message a while back, maybe that day actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And it was just like just remembering of those moments where this community gathered around us and loved us and cared for us and walked with us and gave us space to grieve. That's remarkable. Yeah.
And what an interesting thing that those, I suppose for better or for worse, I'll let you guys decide that. But a few things I referenced were Chase's passing and Alyssa's cancer diagnosis. Yeah. And, you know, a few other things, Bo Stern Brady losing her husband. Those are baked in now to the history and the fabric of the church, like a whole community. So something that is huge for an individual or for a family, even this is now connected to, like, I could draw a straight line between some things that we say regularly in services and even our demeanor and how we speak on certain topics because we waded through and walked through that together, right? And that's, yeah. What feelings does that bring up? It's got to be complicated. On one hand, it's beautiful and heartbreaking, and
it is. It's interesting now visiting other churches and seeing a drastically different ethos of churches that haven't grieved together, and those that have. And of course, Westside is not the only church that's grieved together. There's other churches that have lost significantly, like we have. And there is a difference. There is a different way that you talk about suffering. I think I can say most churches don't have a theology of suffering. I still run into this kind of name it and claim it and just, you know, God is good all the time and, you know, you just got to believe and, you know, and it doesn't give space. It almost removes like the opportunity to be real. And I think that's a gift that Westside continues to offer because we've walked together, is like there's space to be human and to not like come in with everything figured out. And also space to be happy. You know, it's like, you know, there's space for both. There's space. And I think that's one of the powerful things about this community, is that we know how to share each other's burdens and we know how to celebrate each other's wins. And I think that's a gift to people that find themselves at Westside.
I was thinking when you were talking about all that, Ben, on the couple weeks back, so many weren't here for any of that. You know, they're walking alongside Alyssa and I now, and there's obviously always something going on. But as far as these moments that have marked us through suffering, a lot of people weren't here for that. Mm-hmm. But I was reminded of the perspective that it gives us, and you talk to the ethos of the church. It changes us at a root level that I don't think just matters if you were here or not here, mm-hmm. 6, 7 years ago, 5 years ago. But it changes what we care about. It changes what we get worked up about. Mm-hmm. It deflates the power of hype, I think, in a lot of, we talk about this a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Hype is such a, something we all grew up in, I think. You know, the hypier, the better. You know, think of like your craziest youth camp, you know, and that was like the pinnacle of spirituality. But then you walk through real stuff as a community, and it starts to actually be the thing you want to push against, because there's something, I think, more real about deep joy and celebrating each other and suffering and finding Jesus in the middle of that, that just rings hollow if your church is centered around rah-rah, let's go.
Yeah, I'm convinced, Evan, that a church without a theology of suffering and celebration is anemic and will not minister to the common person today. People are not looking. I mean, they might think they are looking for just hype, you know, because hypey churches are growing. So maybe they do want that. But I commend churches that are going like, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to pretend. We're not going to put on a show. We're not going to make believe. We're going to be real. And that, by the way, doesn't always mean like we're sad. Like that, like it just means we bring our full self to our community. And we ask everyone else to do that too, and to give space for that. I mean, I love that even people now know how to walk with people who are going through deep grief, even if they're not going through deep grief. That in and of itself is a powerful witness of Christ's love, is that a community of people know what not to say. They know what to say, if anything. They know how to journey together. That is really unusual and unique, I think, for this community.
Am I remembering right that you called essentially what you're saying, if we don't have a theology of suffering at a district conference, then you call it a BS in not so many words in front of all those pastors, and these platitudes that we say, well, God needed another angel, and you know, we kind of talk about these things that are really deep and valuable in the course of suffering, we gloss over them. Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, I hit it pretty hard, Ben. I don't know if I've said BS or not. It wouldn't surprise me if I have, but I do think, and I have said that without suffering, we can't really know God.
Yeah,
and that's a pretty strong statement. When you like, if you haven't walked with someone or walked yourself through deep suffering, I'm not quite. I think there's a part of God that you're missing, because He suffered, and God suffered on the cross, and He suffered. The Father suffered in watching His Son suffer on the cross, you know. And I think there is something powerful that you don't quite grasp about God unless you're in a community like this.
I wonder if some of the responses we feel around Good Friday, even. Mm-hmm. I know we've had Good Friday services in the middle of the day, and we've been doing it for a few years now, but originally we're like, I don't know, hopefully we can get 25 people out. And
I think 25 was the number, actually, for real.
And hundreds come out to sit in that space. Mm-hmm. And I think it was N.T. Wright, I stole from him this last Good Friday, talking about how all of the Christian ideals of peace and love and joy, when those fail, that's where Jesus meets us on Good Friday, is when love didn't come through for him,
that's
and he was
right.
abandoned, when
that's right.
you know, peace was replaced with violence, when all of the things that Jesus promised in his teachings, when those failed for him, that's the cross. That's Good Friday. Yeah. And so when we feel that in our own suffering, we have a companion in the person of Jesus.
Yeah. Boy, this is really happy conversation we're having, guys. Jeez.
So you're talking about
it's so good.
I'm in a really good spot right now, actually.
It's really good though. You guys, I mean, I'm glad, and I'm glad you guys are like willing to go there. I mean, we didn't plan to go there.
We didn't plan at all.
Yeah, Steve referenced before we hit record.
what are we talking about?
Yeah, that's right.
But I just so value that. That we can have this conversation and it's not awkward and it's heavy in a sense of like, we know there's deep waters here, but it's not like this weighty, like, you know, it's like this, it's life and we're okay with it. And we can be joyful in the middle of it too. Like, that's amazing. Like, it's, you know, I mean, it's, we hold these things in tension, right? This deep suffering and this deep joy that coincide together. And it is, like I said, it's a real gift. This has been
so formative for the community, of course, but I would say especially, I don't want to project on you, Evan, but for Evan and I, where it is interesting, even watching us do this podcast right now, there's almost a comfort or a depth that comes into the conversation. I think when we do allow ourselves to talk about grief and suffering, and why do you think that is for us, Evan, that this kind of suits us? Is it a response to some of the upbringing that we had where this was skipped over, or what do you think?
I think I hesitate to want to like, oh, trash on, you know,
no, our for upbringing. Sure. Of course.
Yeah. Or the churches we grew up in. But I just think some things are learned through the journey. Like, there's no substitute. You can't read about suffering and then get it. And I just, like you're saying, Steve, I think you meet Jesus in a way that there's no replacement for until you're in the valley. And so maybe that's it. We want to lean into it because we've seen the effect of what it is to stand shoulder to shoulder on the worst day.
Yeah, and you guys, and I'll answer the question, Ben, for a little bit for you.
Since I did a poor job.
Like, you guys resisted any urge, if there was any at all, to gloss over Bo's suffering or my suffering or your own suffering, Evan. I think you guys just refuse to do that. And I think a lot of church leaders in particular feel like they've got to get through it as fast as possible. Otherwise, you're going to get stuck there, you know? And so your guys' willingness to not do that. And I think of other leaders that have journeyed with us through this, that let it be what it is without feeling like you got to get over it, you know? And like, when is this season going to be done? You know? And so I think that, you guys leading that way, has been a gift.
I think it's made me feel like the faith is as broad as it is or mm-hmm. as deep as it is. If grief, at least in my interpretation as a child, was, yeah, you hit this real quick, but then it's a stepping stone to a greater victory, right? And the faster you can do that, the more mature your faith is, because you're just skipping off the water and into something better. And I think that created a little bit of a fear in me of like, oh shoot, man, if we ever hit something tough or I'm wondering and I'm confused and angry, that's fine for a second. You got to bounce out of it. And I think the environment that was created here by you guys and how you led was this, no, we can just sit on the ground for a while and weep, and actually heaven comes to us in that. It's not, this is a stop and then we're going to get back into the heavenly things. That God can meet us there. You know, it reminds me of the piece from the Silver Chair that you did share. By the way, you read like a long piece of
long,
that.
Long.
I was section. So happy that you you just kept going. I don't know how everybody else feels. Maybe Lindsay's got some either. Criticism for you.
It was great.
Yeah.
I think so.
But it is like this, we hit these moments, and I think the underworld is supposed to represent this, of this real confusion and haze of, we go down in here, we forget that what was above ever even existed, that it's actually our imaginations that are playing off the things that we do know in the underworld that is tricking us into believing that there's something else. And you do hit this hazy puddle glum, I guess there never was anything else, and this is what we do. And then Aslan, right, or God meets us in that place, and that's the revelation. It's not that we never go into the underworld, it's that when we do, God meets us there.
Yeah, and if that's the case, then why would we discourage suffering in people's lives? I mean, I don't wish suffering on anyone. I don't want it for myself, you know? I don't like, but I do like, I think it was in Harry Potter, Welcome Death Like an Old Friend. is a quote in there. Mm-hmm. There's something about this, like this idea of welcoming suffering in, because it's an avenue toward knowing God in that space, mm-hmm. better than you can know him in any other space. Mm-hmm. So
I think of Psalm 23. I reference it a lot lately. It's part of our prayers that I think mm-hmm. all three of us do. Mm-hmm. Not every day, but frequently.
Steve, almost every day.
Yeah. Almost every day. Almost every day. I pray when I run. So if I don't run every day, then I don't pray.
We should post that prayer liturgy for people, because we talk about it a lot and never allow people in on it. But I think of Psalm 23, and maybe this, going back to the question, but maybe this is why I feel a gravitational pull to sitting thoroughly in these spaces. It's because I think my understanding of faith early on was like the first half of Psalm 23. And if you could stay in that space, you were, you know, God was blessing you and you're doing everything right. But as you walk through life, you realize like, oh no, it's the whole Psalm. It's the valley of the shadow of death where he's with us. And it's the table set before us in the presence of our enemies that actually comes before goodness and mercy following after us all the days of our lives and dwelling really in the house of the Lord forever.
Yes.
And it's that holistic thing. That's the only way I want to give my life to this stuff, you know? And at our age, Ben, you know, I think we're solidly in the, are giving our lives to this, right? Steve, for sure, years ago. But like, if we're going to do this, I want to know that that this can handle the second half.
Yes.
I don't want a faith that like gets me to verse 4 and then is like, sorry.
Yes.
Like, good God.
And there's so much joy on the other side. Whether it's this earthly side or the next side, you know, with heaven, but I've experienced like, you know, surely goodness and mercy. I've experienced that in this life, and I think because we've suffered together, when we do experience goodness and mercy, it means even more than it would otherwise.
And I want to say thank you for bringing us into that conversation so willingly. You know, this didn't just happen because you grieved and you did it from a distance. You know, you really embraced it with us, and we're honest in meetings, from everything from service planning to what we were teaching, right? And that is, I was watching a video of a coach the other day talk to a player through who had come to her and was saying, hey, it really bugs me how I'm being treated with whatever. And she was then teaching him how to go to them and share that kind of intimate level of detail of like, when you do this, it makes me scared or makes me feel left out or whatever. But she said, really what it is by you going to them is it's an invitation into something that will grow the relationship and grow all of you together. And so there's this difficult mesh point. But if you do this, if you're willing to share your intimacy and your fears, the whole group actually grows. So selfishly, that's how I've gotten to experience so much of this conversation. But like I said, it hasn't been because we've watched you, we've sat with you and spoken in depth with you.
Yeah.
What a beautiful gift that we can give each other, I think, in these moments.
It's, no words to describe that, the depth of that, what that means relationally, what that means in a community, what that means as a for a church. I mean, it's just, it's deep, deep waters, you know, it really is. And again, you know, it's not like, you know, let's run to suffering, everybody. It's like this, it's what you do with it when it does come, and how do you, and I can't imagine, I mean, I know people who walk alone through deep suffering, and they don't make it. They just don't make it in all kinds of ways, you know? And I'm just so grateful. And I think back to why that 70th anniversary was so meaningful for me, Evan, it was because of that. Just realizing that I'm like 100% confident I would not have made it without this community through the loss of Chase.
So how has it shaped your prayer? We've talked about some of the prayer routines. Can you describe some things over the last 5, 6, 7 years that we played a, I called it a game. It wasn't really a game, but I was like, Evan, I'm going to name these 5 things. You tell me if they're prayer.
Were there some things that you were doing that after a little while you were like, you know, I think I'm praying and maybe I'm super angry, or maybe I'm just sitting here crying, or maybe I'm thinking about, is there anything that surprised you that you go, you know, that's actually prayer to me?
Okay. Well, I mean, we're talking about suffering, I guess, but in the darkest part of my suffering, for whatever reason, my religious upbringing, and I even had somebody come up to me and say at a church service, when I kind of described being angry with God, that it was sin. To be angry with God was sin. And I remember feeling that tension of like being so angry with God, but not able to verbalize it. Not able to tell him about it. I mean, he knows. I mean, he knows everything, and so he knows what's going on inside. But I just kept it in, and I remember going out to nature, and I'm feeling like I had permission from God, sort of, but also wondering if this was it, if this was the end of the moment when I decided to curse God, and found that found his embrace even more. You know, it's just, it's like, so yeah, that one surprised me, Ben, about like, that's prayer, cursing God. I mean, you know, and I'm still nervous. I wouldn't like encourage people to do it, but I also found, you know, and that's when I felt like the story of Jacob wrestling with God became more real to me, was in that moment. Like, because, you know, we think, you know, growing up in the church, wrestling, Jacob wrestling with God, it was like, you know, two arms on a shoulder kind of going back and forth, like, where I'm going to get you. But wrestling, I mean, if you've wrestled, you're on the ground, you are rolling in the dirt, your hands are all over each other. There is intimacy in that. And I didn't experience that intimacy with God in prayer to the level that until I went all the way and told him exactly what I thought about him. And, you know, I also realized I had no idea what I was talking about. Like, I had a lot of things to say to God, and God took it and then softly reminded me, were you there when I created the universe? You know, do you know what you're talking about? And God's like, no, I have no idea. I have no idea who I'm talking about. I know so little about God. There's so much more to know. Mm-hmm. And I think prayers bring us into that place of knowing.
And that's the Job response, right, to suffering. And and God says, were you there when I laid up the storehouses of snow and all that? But then we get Jesus.
Yes.
And in Jesus, we have the God who no longer just speaks from the whirlwind or whatever it is in Job and declares things about us. We have a Jesus who is weeping in John 11. We have a Jesus who is
acquainted with our grief
and stooping in the dirt. And so what a beautiful story that we're told through the Gospels, that this God who is, you know, so distant and far, but you still got to pray and you still got to be faithful, and yeah, he can handle your complaints like David, but don't go too far.
Yeah.
Because do you know who you're talking to?
Yeah.
And then Jesus comes and he's like, you know, right next to us and eye to eye, and what a beautiful companion in suffering.
It's amazing. And that's why I think my prayer life has changed dramatically. It's not about, I do have set times when I pray, and I have set prayers that I pray, like we've talked about, but it's an ongoing like conversation. I know there was a season where I was like, well, you just, you know, I pray all day, so I don't really have my prayer time. And I'm like, well, that's a cop out, to be honest. Like, that just means I'm not really spending any time in prayer. And so I have both now, where I feel like there's this ongoing conversation with God that is, with Jesus in particular, that is really, really intimate. And like, he said, I now call you brothers and I call you friends. There's something about like this familial relationship that we can have through Christ, and like, why wouldn't we want to spend time with him in prayer in those spaces, you know? Yeah.
And you talked about this yesterday. I think suffering, the conversation around suffering, which so rich and deep, speaks to the deep waters of the overall mystery of Christ that we're invited into.
Yeah.
You referenced, Zahn talks about reenchanting. I think it's actually a friend of his wrote a book called The Reenchantment of the Christian Faith or something along those lines. But this idea of being invited back into mystery, I think, you know, probably the last 150 years after the Enlightenment or whatever, all of a sudden Christianity decided, well, we've got to like argue faith on enlightenment terms.
Yeah.
So it's going to be logic and reason, and we're going to prove things, and no disrespect to great apologetic writers and Josh McDowell and Case for Christ, and that has been a wonderful tool yeah. in evangelism. And yet, post-enlightenment, it's like we've moved out of the space of mystery, and we've tried to distill everything into a test tube and then deliver it to people.
Yeah.
And it lacks the original intent.
Yeah, exactly, Evan. I mean, I think we could probably post Zahn's message that I borrowed from. I'm slow to say that because you'll notice, oh, he really borrowed heavily from Zahn's message. But he talks about that, Evan, in his message about this modernism and enlightenment and how we haven't really disengaged from that yet in Christianity, where we're still stuck in logic and proof texting and making sure that, you know, that everything that's in the Bible can be proven scientifically and all of this stuff. That's fine. I don't mind the work. But for me, it feels like a waste of energy. Like, if you're going to put that same energy to proof texting the Bible, like, put that energy into discovery of the mystery of God. That feels like way more worthwhile, like, because you'll find that there's things that you didn't know about God. How is that possible? Everything you need to know about God is in the Bible. And I'm like, well, yeah, but there's a lot there that we don't know, that we don't understand, that's in the Bible. And so there's more to discover. And I think that mystery beckons us, invites us to journey, right? To get in there and say, oh, what do I not know about God? You know?
And it's the pockets of what we don't know, I think, that are the most compelling. When we've decided we know everything and we've explored every space of our faith, there's not a lot of life in that, right? But when it's this inviting mystery, I think that's really compelling. I wanted to read this quote. This Jesuit theologian, Karl Rahner, died in 1984. And back in his day, he wrote, "The Christian of the future will be a mystic or will not exist." And I love this idea of it's okay to not know everything about faith.
Yeah,
it's not the highest pinnacle of faith to be convinced and certain about everything. Yeah. That's not the best way, right?
Well, is it faith? Is it really faith? If you're more and more certain about what you know, then I don't really need faith at that point. I'm certain. And faith is the certainty of things hoped for. So I'm not saying that we should get rid of all certainty, but there's something really beautiful that I'm choosing to believe, even though I don't know everything about this, and I'm still in it, and I'm still curious, and I still don't understand why my son died. Back to suffering. I'm still interested in that conversation, you know. And so there's still depths to mine in who God is. And that, and you don't get there if you've taken all the mystery out of your faith. You don't even go on that journey, you know. You don't even, like, and Jesus said, like, you know, those who seek will find. I want to take the pickaxe and go mine the mountain of God and see what else is there that I haven't seen yet. But you can't do that if you're just certain about everything. You've created this box, this world that everything fits in and it's just right, and you don't mess with it until your son dies, and then God seems to mess with it and says, "There's more to know of me," you know. And like, let's go. Let's figure that one out. Like, that's exciting to me because I mean, if I am not bored with my relationship with my wife. Like, I'm still learning things about Suzanne 32 years in that I didn't know when we first got married, you know? And she's changed and I've changed and we're just discovering each other. Isn't that what keeps relationships, like, fresh and alive? And, you know, it's not like, well, I figured her out. I know exactly what she's going to say at every moment. I mean, how boring. I mean, we should surprise each other every once in a while.
That's why I liked your use of the word enchantment. I thought that was so wonderful. And it just made sense. You know, mystical things make sense to us in kind of that theological context.
Yeah.
But I think especially for the group and for myself as well, you say the word enchantment, it's like, yeah, we're seeing something and we're experiencing something. And I think we've come up with some ideas and rhythms of how things can work. And yet so often in something that's enchanted, right? There's rules that we will never learn or don't fully understand while we still see and feel an experience of it. I just thought that was a brilliant use of the word.
It's a dangerous word in the church because it you know, there are people that have grown up in the church, they go, enchanted, that's like a magic word, or that's like evil, or that's like, you know,
you already witches. Said Harry Potter.
I did quote for Harry Potter. I'm so sorry. Yeah. And so I think it's, but I do think we've got to use words that shake us a little bit, that cause us to think differently. Because if I could have used the word mystery through the whole message, but I don't think people would have leaned in.
Yeah.
Even if they're angry leaning in, even if they're like, I don't like, what is he talking about? That's leaning in. Let's go, you know? And so, yeah.
So to the critic who, when you talk about enchantment, they're immediately thinking about, you know, magical thinking and manifesting, you know, your vision board and, you know.
And in Oregon, mushrooms.
Yeah, mushrooms, there you go.
Tell us about your vision boards.
And even, you know, some of the, in the Christian circles, the name it and claim it and kind of, you know, you just look into your future and you demand God do. Some of that starts to feel like, is that what he's talking about, this enchantment?
Yeah.
What do you say to that critique?
Well, I mean, it's funny. I mean, I'm like, well, we could use a little bit more of that in our faith. I mean, that's what I would be like, why, what are you afraid of? Like, if you actually believe who you say you believe about God, that he's over all things and he's the creator of all things, and why are we so afraid to discover new things and to use different words to try to figure him out? The early church, they borrowed heavily from culture, the words that were used, to, especially John in his gospel. There's just so many words that he borrowed from the culture that would probably have the same, like I'm not sure about light of the world, bread, you know, the bread of heaven and things like this. Like what is he talking about? And so I think we've got to be creative, in expressing, you know, how do we find God? How do we discover him? So yeah, that's what I would say to them. They you know, people that have a problem with the word are just going to have a problem with the word.
Well, funny that two of the biggest, we would say, Christian authors that released themselves Christian, you know, Tolkien and Lewis come up all the time. They wanted to play in this sandbox more than anything else. And I got to believe that absolutely. It's because they felt like this might actually be the more clear way to describe
what Lewis, the scripture's talking about. Lewis encouraged us to read fairy tales. I mean, he encouraged that. Why? Because they're real? Because we'll get truth from them? No, because it awakens something that a lot of times in the traditional church we've let lie dormant, this sense of like curiosity. That's the best word for it. Like, I wonder what I don't know, you know, and I wonder what's out there, you know. And everyone knows. I mean, I refrain from, you know, Lord of the Rings quotes, Star Wars, Jedi quotes. I mean, Jedi, I could have gone heavy on the Force, you guys.
Let's go.
But
that's for the podcast.
I restrained. But I choose to believe that there are things in this world that I don't know yet, and there are powers at work that I don't understand, and I'm really interested in that. You know, and I don't think you discover those by reading a book only. I think you've got to like get in it and open your mind to the creator and see what he has to say about it, because there is a spiritual realm. And I didn't talk too much about that. I mean, I talked about heaven, but that was a safe way to talk about. I mean, there are dark forces at work. There are good forces at work, and this gets into the weird woo-woo stuff, you know. and yet, I know that there's more to discover of that world, the overworld, underworld, all of that.
That was Zahn's example in his book that we took from, right? I think it was in When Everything's on Fire. He talks about mysticism being the person who studies the peach versus the person who has eaten one. And so you have somebody that spends a decade of their life taking pictures of the peach and putting it under a microscope and understanding its makeup and chemically what it exists. And then you have a person that spends a single moment simply biting into it. Now, tell me which one is the expert, the one who has never tasted but has studied, and the one who has never studied but has simply tasted. And I think that's what you're talking about, this invitation to sometimes play even in this space and wonder, live in that curiosity is a biting of the peach when it can be safe to actually dedicate your life to simply this arms distance studying version of.
Yeah, and even that verse I use where Jesus comes down and sees that the seizures the little boy was having was caused by the demonic. I mean, I quickly glossed over that, you know, because our culture, we're just not like demonic seizures, you know, and all of that. But I pray, my prayers now for my boys, especially after Chase died, when Jesus says, taught us to pray to keep us from evil. I don't think it's metaphorical. I think there's evil. And I think that the enemy has come to steal, kill, and destroy. And I think that's real. And so, and I'm not afraid, but I know that in me, through Christ is the power to come against that and to pray. So I pray every day for my boys, that Jesus, you would keep them from evil, that you would not allow, Satan, the evil one, to have his way. In their life. And I actually think that daily prayer is making a difference. You know, I really do think that Jesus hears and listens and responds. And I don't think it's like some, you know, if I don't pray the prayer, then who knows what's going to happen. Sure. I think God's bigger than that. But I know that my small part in bringing heaven to earth is through my prayers. That I pray, I try to pray every day, not every day, but I try to pray every day.
The power of prayer is in how it shapes us. However, I believe that to stop there is to maybe a little bit of a cop out again. Yeah. It's safe to say, well, this is just going to shape me.
Yeah.
And I think you even quoted a quote that says, you know, the primary purpose of was it Willard? Purpose. Primary purpose of our prayers to that we are formed.
Yeah, formed us, yeah.
true. But we're called to pray for people to be healed.
Yeah.
We're called for the supernatural to happen. We're called for heaven to come to earth.
Yes. And what if? Yeah. I used to be like, well, if I don't know God's will, and if I don't know he absolutely wants to heal that person, then I don't know if I should pray for that. And then you got the theology that says, well, he always wants to heal that person, and maybe he hasn't yet, but he has. But if you pray it, he started it. And I'm just like, I don't have enough brain power for that. I'm just like going to pray. And God gives the increase. God does the work. It's not just by me praying, but there is something like he said, you will do greater things than these than I did. I mean, you. So I'm just like, all right, let's go. Let's see what happens, you know, and just a little bit of faith. I was telling Suzanne yesterday, I was feeling like, you know, that idea of this, if faith of a mustard seed, the size of a mustard seed can move mountains. I realized that it's not the amount of faith we have. Because I think that I just don't have enough faith. I always hear that. I just don't have enough faith to pray for fill in the blank. And I now realize that I think, well, I don't think it's the amount of faith. I think it's what we believe about God that makes the difference. It's what we believe, not how much we believe it. And I think that, and so now, and so I'm just even refocusing my attention on God's ability. I want to know more of his will. I want to know, like, is it his design? That's why Jesus was so successful, by the way, in healing people. It's not just because he was the Son of God, but because he knew the Father's will. And so he would pray. He knew that God wanted to heal that person, so you pray for that person. That's a pretty good shot of being 100% accurate, you know, when you know God's going to do something. We don't always have that luxury, and so I think we have to, like, lean in and go, like, God, I know you're able to do incredible things. Mm-hmm. And I'm in. I want to see it. And I don't want to just talk about it, and I don't want to just preach about it. I want to see it. And I just think like there's this hunger rising up in me to see the manifest power of God again. And it might get weird, I don't know, but I hope, you know, I'm not worried about that anymore, you know. But I want to see God move. We need him to move. I mean, our culture, our society, the sickness, cancer, it's just gotten out of hand. And why not? Why not in our generation see the hand of God if we just have the courage to really believe that God is able, you know?
So how do we describe for the listener how we hold both of these things in our hands that we've been discussing this whole podcast, right? Because I think one of the reasons that a lot of churches don't do grief very well is because it seems like it's to spend time grieving and suffering is to speak against what we believe mm-hmm. about God, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. you just said, like, how what do we believe about God? This is incredibly important. And to stop and to say, I am suffering and I'm going to rip my clothes and I don't understand why. It feels like those two don't go together for a lot of people, right? Yeah, I think, and that's why we get either the, this whole faith thing is stupid and I'm walking away because I can't handle it. It's not in reality. Yeah. And then the other side that says, we're going to pretend that we've never suffered before and we're going to close our eyes and sing louder. How do these things go together? I believe they do.
Yeah, that's a great question, Ben. I think there is, we just need resolution. So in our finite minds, we need certainty. So either give it to me or it's not real. I got to see it or it's just not, it's not real. And I think there's this place of like, we need to pray that God's kingdom would come here on earth as it is in heaven. Just by the fact that Jesus told us to pray for that means that it's not always going to occur because we got to pray for it to happen. But it doesn't guarantee that it's always going to happen because in this world you will have trouble. So it's like, so he lived in this tension, Ben, that I think we know that we are broken people and that the trajectory of life is from birth to what? Death. No amount of prayers can change that reality. Only Christ coming can change that reality. And one day he will return, I think, and kick this whole system in its teeth. But for now, we atrophy. And even, I've heard preachers joke that, Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, but Lazarus still died again. Poor guy had to do it twice, And I think, but just for that, just because Lazarus died a second time doesn't mean that he won't raise him from the dead once for a reason, for a purpose. And we may not know all the reasons why God does or doesn't intervene in power. But that doesn't mean we should just like, well, we're all going to die and that's just the way it is, I'd rather see some magical stuff now. I'd rather see some enchantment happening around me today and just see what Jesus might do. Even though I know that we're all going to get sick again and we're all going to die one day. Super fun. But I'd rather see some magical works of God.
Yeah. And it creates tension. The tension that Jesus was comfortable with is the tension we're all invited into. And enchantment is tension because it's the unbelievable.
Yeah.
All of a sudden taking effect in spaces where it doesn't compute and, the rational conclusion breaks down. That's kind of the invitation, I think, into following Jesus is come be comfortable with tension. Come be comfortable when things don't resolve. Come be comfortable with just beauty and heartbreak just colliding all the time.
Yes.
And I think of all the people that, have come through our doors here, and people I grew up with and those that have walked far away from faith. I think it's those that we promise so much certainty to that when tension entered the picture, they couldn't compute. And so they walk away. Not the only reason, but, far better just right up front. Say, you want to come to Jesus? It's going to be filled with things that don't compute. And that's the beauty of it. It's going to break your heart.
Yeah.
And it's going to wrap its arms around you.
And maybe that's where we get the don't grow weary in doing good idea. Mm-hmm. Right. Because even as you're saying, I totally agree with everything you're saying. And I'm going, and if you give me enough tension over time, eventually I will want to go, I'm so tired of dealing with this responsibly in the place of tension. I think that's why people pick political parties the way that they do, and they pick an ethos about their life. And I'm just going to forget it. I'm just going to go this way. Yeah. I don't care if it's right or wrong anymore because I'm tired of making the decisions and living in the tension. I'm just going to run that direction. Yeah. And I think that's maybe where we're encouraged. Don't get tired of this because this is actually the work, right? Yeah. This, I don't know every single answer in a moment and every single thing. I don't know everything that I'm going to encounter in my life, but I'm going to slowly and patiently and carefully and prayerfully walk through it. That's the good that we need to not grow.
And isn't it true that even the once every few year healing that you might see, I mean, whatever it is, doesn't that encourage you like, oh, that's right. That's what's waiting for us is there isn't going to be any death, and there isn't going to be any tears, and there's not going to be any sickness. And every once in a while, if we're enchanted enough to have faith for it, we might see a glimmer of heaven here on earth, and that gives us hope that there's something far grander waiting for us on the other side. But I worry a little bit when we don't see glimpses of heaven here on earth, when we just, this is all there is. You know, I'm like, oh, no, there's not. So I think that's one of the reasons that we need to see heaven here on earth, is for us to long for the real when we get glimpses of it here.
Yeah. Tim Mackey did a great job. I think he was talking about Jesus' teachings on the kingdom of heaven. And he drew this picture of how you have earth that's been corrupt, right? It's not right. And you have heaven and the place where God is and its perfection. And Jesus comes, he stands in the overlap of those two. And every time he's healing, every time he's pulling bits of that heaven into earth.
Heaven, that's exactly right.
And then
right.
he and Jesus invites us through the apostles to stand in that same space. And every day, just pull heaven and earth until that one day when heaven fully eclipses this chaotic space and all is healed and all is made right. But until then, man, we're standing in that little sliver where heaven and earth are colliding. Yeah. And as representation, right, of the work that Jesus started, of just saying, this isn't going to fix everything, but in this moment, through prayer, I'm going to pull a little bit of what God's world looks like into this one.
Absolutely. I mean, I think of Peter's shadow healing people.
Right.
I mean, if that's not magical, I don't know what is. I mean, his shadow healing people. Like, what? I mean, that, yeah. I mean, you're right. Just a glimmer. And we all know that as you read through the book of Acts, we see so much manifestation of God's power early on. And we see less of it, at least recorded in the narrative, but it still happens. And I think and I think maybe because of the birthing of the church, maybe there was more that happened then. I don't know. I think there's a lot of people that argue that. But I would not argue that it's all gone. Because we still need to see the manifest presence and power of God. I think this generation in particular, we've tried to argue them to Christ. We've tried to scare them, you know, fire and brimstone, going to hell. You know, we've tried things. Have we tried the mystical? Have we tried, like, God actually shows up sometimes? And I think when they or their friends get healed, or they get a vision from God, or I mean, pretty hard for them not to like at least take a second and go to church somewhere and go like, is this real? I don't know what happened, but I had a dream last night and I think it was Jesus, you know, and whatever. However that would happen, I think we need that. We need that.
And maybe that's why spaces like that can go off the rails easily. Is because, you know, if we're talking about spiritual forces, what is more dangerous than people that are tapped into this heaven coming to earth? And so, you know, I don't think it poses any danger to evil and darkness for us just to have a strictly intellectual understanding of, you know, the rationality of Scripture.
Wow.
That is not dangerous.
No.
But when we step into these spaces where we believe that a supernatural God is at work and active, and that becomes, I think, a big target. And I think we see it over and over again where movements that are, you know, leaning into Holy Spirit work often go off the rails. Because I think they're maybe at the front line and can be corrupted or swayed. Yeah. And so how much more important than not to push away from that completely, but go back and say, no, we want to reclaim the work of the Holy Spirit for the things that look like the fruit of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And not all the other things that it gets.
Well, it's part of the trick, trusting the Holy Spirit to actually do the work too. I think that might be where things get off the rails, is we buy into this, we get other people to invest, and then we want to show them a return on investment that looks like a very specific thing, a very specific return. And I know you guys have never been insecure, but I can be an insecure leader. And it's tempting to make stuff up to move the goalposts, to say, no, we actually did the thing.
And especially in this, Ben, we can manipulate. You know, we can say, God said. I mean, that's really easy for us to say from the pulpit.
Yeah.
God said this or God's doing this. And because of our positions, people will believe it. And then but there'll be people in the back of the church going like, yeah, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And so it has to be authentic. Whatever this is that we're talking about has to be authentic. It can't be made up. It can't be manipulated. It can't be something that we conjure up, you know. It has to be authentic. It has to be like, I was blind, but now I see. Mm-hmm. I was sick, but now I'm healed, you know. And it's like it has to have worked through us and not something back to hype. People have used the Holy Spirit to hype. And still to this day, there's churches that use the Holy Spirit to hype up their services. And I'm like, no. Mm-hmm. Like, we've got to be authentic about it, but not afraid of it either.
Do you feel in your role the freedom to speak into churches in these ways? Because you could just steward and manage in your role. Do you feel like you're able to speak prophetically or spiritually into the churches you're overseeing?
Yeah, without a doubt, Evan. I don't know how much people receive it, though. So it's like, you know what I'm saying? Like that's one of the being part of a community where you have life with people. The authority that you bring is relational authority. It's not positional authority. But in this position, I'm coming into churches with a title on my back that they don't know me. They don't know my story of suffering. They don't know my relationship with God. They haven't seen it worked out in the hallways of the church office and in the, you know, in my bedroom crying with a couple of leaders. They haven't seen that. And so coming in and having these words from God, which I do believe I have, it's almost like a prophet like coming in and just like spouting it off and saying, this is what I see. And you just got to let Jesus take it and run with it. And there's not, I can't manipulate it. I can't force it. But it is an opportunity and I take it. I mean, we have like you said, I'm from Seattle to North Dakota and I can, the way that people think about all of these things mm-hmm. is so drastically different, that I know that there will be places that are a little bit more opposed to these ideas. But I still feel like I got to bring it and let the pastors and churches kind of figure it out after I leave. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I don't get to walk with them like I did here at Westside for mm-hmm. years and years and years, hopefully embodying something, right? Yeah. I don't get to do that in this role. So it is more of a prophetic utterance coming in to a community and speaking the word of the Lord and then leaving.
Yeah. I want to bring Lindsay into the conversation real quick, actually. He's off screen producing with us. Lindsay, have you seen, you're our worship pastor, have you seen the meme from probably something more anti-church of, I used to think God moved in worship services, but it turns out I just really like the drums. Have you seen that?
No.
And it does highlight this thing to me of like, the music is a powerful thing, and I've been moved by the Holy Spirit in that. And I know as my experience as a worship leader, it's tempting to try to push mm-hmm. like Steve was talking about, right? And can we manipulate people into this space? How do you as a leader consider this, leading people into a holy place with the Holy Spirit? And also, you're setting the tempos of the songs and the dynamics. Mm-hmm. How do you consider all these things when you lead people in worship on a weekend?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'm pretty anti-hype. I share similar sentiments as you all, because I've been a part of services or camps or whatnot where it is abused a bit, and it's yeah. used to create a reaction in oftentimes students, kids. But from where I sit, thinking about, you know, I've seen other memes that say, you know, or videos or whatnot saying like there's actually notes that you can play yeah. that evoke an emotional response in people, and that's all churches are doing. And I'm like, well, who created the emotional response in humans?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who created music to resonate with us in this way? And so I know where I'm coming from in preparation for a worship set, and I tend to be maybe more hands-off than than I should be. But it's one of those things that it's like you all enter in. Like, I'm setting the table as best I can, and it's on you, church, to enter in, to eat, to pick at whatever is there, and I'm going to do the best I can, trusting that if emotional responses are evoked in you because of the chord progression we are playing, I'm trusting that's God. Like, maybe that's a little bit of magic too. You know, the way he created us to respond to certain things in certain ways. It's never my intention to create those moments, but I always find that I experience them, and that's pretty special and magical. So,
yeah, what if those notes, because I have thought this, Lindsay, all the time, like, we're so manipulative, you know? Because I know if I play A minor, you know, it's gonna. But what if there's something actually scientific about this note that opens our souls? Like, we don't know yet everything about our bodies and how our minds and everything connect. And what if these sounds that come into us actually create space? For then anything, actually, not just God, right, to come into, but that creates this space for God to do something in a church service. I think there's actually something to it. Like, I think there's like, probably, I don't know if it's, we could prove it scientifically or not, but I think there's something that like resonates in us that opens our hearts to the magical.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting.
And good luck pulling all that stuff out, like story. It engages your imagination as manipulation. No more stories. Okay. The temperature in the room, if it's comfortable, that could be manipulated. Okay, we're going to make it uncomfortable, you know. And you start going down this road too far, and you come to a place that's a dead end.
Yeah.
You can't remove all the ways that the human experience connects with spirituality and expect there to be this really life-giving thing at the end of that. Like, no, I think it's all connected. Mm. Like, so bring on the most beautiful music, bring on the best storytelling, bring on the most humorous, you know, illustrations, Ben. Come on, man.
Yeah. Nobody watches a movie and goes, Hans Zimmer scored this thing? Oh, geez. All right, well, it's kind of cheating, but fine. I mean, I guess I'll feel something at the end of this and it'll create an emotional response. And,
I'm more of a John Williams guy, but Hans Zimmer's fine.
Oh, yeah, fine. Do we know any others after those two?
Howard Shore,
the Lord of the Rings guy, also did Seven. did you Seven, know this?
Really?
Crazy!
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, it is not like Lord of the Rings. Let me tell you that. For those of you who haven't watched Seven in a while,
I haven't watched.
Oddly, John Williams is one of those guys where every once in a while I check to make sure he hasn't died. Do you ever do this with celebrities?
Oh, for sure.
Is he still alive?
I hope he's still alive. He's still alive.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, they just did the whole like dedication thing for him the other night, right?
Yeah, I think because he scored the final Indiana Jones, not a great film, but he scored the final Indiana Jones, and he said that's going to be his last.
He did.
He's retired.
Okay.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford was great on
that.
But
I mean, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Hook, beautiful score, E.T., Jurassic Park.
How do you know this stuff,
Evan? I'm a big John Williams.
Oh my gosh.
But think about Jurassic Park without the score.
Right.
It is an average B movie monster film. You put that hymn of a score in.
Amazing.
Da, 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 and you see those, what, Brachiosaurus, Brontosaurus in the distance.
Brachiosaurus.
It's deeply moving. And that's all John Williams.
John Williams at Home Alone. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, that is the crazy one. That. Movie's good, right? Macaulay Culkin. That the score.
Yeah.
Will like make me cry at Home Alone. It's really fascinating how that works.
I'm telling you, Jaws. He did Jaws.
That's right.
It's all John Williams. I'm telling you, that man is a genius.
Check and see if he's dead.
Best storyteller of a generation, right there.
Did you see the Harrison Ford thing?
Like, no, I'm crazy.
I'm just like politely listening to you guys. I have no idea what you're talking about.
You don't.
I don't know. I don't know any of these people. I know the scores, but I don't know.
Well, don't you appreciate that we get to nerd?
I love
for
that.
A second,
I know exactly.
You're looking.
I know. I know.
I'm just telling you. You wouldn't love Star Wars the way you do if not for John Williams.
Yes, I agree. I think you.
No, look at me. I always think of when it comes to the nerding out stuff, I just imagine Dave Daly watching you talk about Star Wars. That was one of my favorite former pastor here.
He was so fed up with that.
He would check out 20 seconds into a metaphor.
So fed up.
I think everyone else is leaning in though to give you credit. It's just not Dave's.
I think there's probably a few others.
I don't know. Dave's at the top of the list though. Okay. Well, Steve, Thank you for both coming today, but also for this year. You've spoken here a lot of times. I know that's probably a little bit out of guilt because you left us.
It was. I felt bad.
But you've been back. You keep showing up, and we so appreciate that you still have a voice in this church and this community, and especially for Ben and I. So we love you. I think we're supposed to get a meal together tomorrow. Yeah,
I think so. We'll do it.
We'll just listen to John Williams.
Turn the music off. I'm going to finish this episode
and cry together. All right. Go ahead, Ben.
Da, 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 da. I didn't think you were actually going to do it.
That was the worst.
This is Behind the Message.